We can talk about prison fellowship ministry, but I want to talk a little bit in general about prison ministry first, because prison fellowship ministry isn't the only ministry in prison. I want to give credit where credit is due. Prison is a growth industry nowadays. Since 73, we've tripled the size of state prisons. About a year and a half ago, the federal government passed new legislation, which the Bureau of Federal Prison figures that in 5 years would double the population in the federal prisons. I was just down in Georgia, and they already have 28 state prisons, and they plan, they have in the works now 10 more prisons they're going to build. Just came out of state of New Mexico, the same thing's happening there. Your own state, I understand, or not your state, but the state of Washington, is planning 6 new prisons. And so that's the growth that's happening out there. And it's interesting that about half the people who are in prison have been in prison before. And talking to Michael Quinlan, who was the head of the Bureau of Federal Prisons, about that and the estimate of the growth of federal prisons, and he said, and you realize that it doesn't do any good. And the people I talk to in state prisons say the same thing, it doesn't do any good. For some reason or other, we've gotten the idea that throw them in prison. I'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, but that's sort of what the thrust that we're on now. Get tough, throw them in prison. And to me, it's a college course in crime. A St. Olaf graduate went to Minnesota prison for his forging a check. And after that, he learned how to be a burglar. And so the next time he went for that. And so prison ministry, then, are a group of people who have on their heart the admonition that Christ gave the 25th chapter of Matthew, that besides feeding the hungry and giving a drink to the thirsty and clothing the naked and reaching out to the foreigner and visit when they're sick, but also to visit him in prison. And that's really the thrust behind the Christian's motivation to move into prison. And there are about four things that happen in ministries. One is evangelism in the prisons, and an example of evangelism on an organization, not prison fellowship ministries, is the Bill Glass. Bill Glass is a football player who now for a number of years has been going into prisons evangelizing. And his technique is to go in there with the four spiritual laws and sit down with an inmate and carry him through that, and they make their commitment to Christ. And so he talks about, and I saw him in Georgia, he said 3,000 people have made a commitment to Christ this year, in 1990. And as a Lutheran, you know, that is a little different than the way we look at it, but at least there are people moving there. There's a tendency to be open to Christ more in jail than in prison. And if you were like me before I got into this, I didn't know the difference between jail and prison. But in most states, anything up to a year is jail, and anything over a year, the state takes control of, and it's prison. So you can use that benchmark as a short term. And when a person is in prison the first time, and everything they kind of lost at that time, and the guilt of what they did wrong comes upon them, they're more open then to looking at their spiritual side of their life and what they did wrong. And the people who I call the midwives, people who God has given the talents to reach people, and so they do come to know Christ, find them more open at that time. There's a greater number than otherwise. Of course, there's jailhouse religion as well, which if people think they have a way of getting out quicker if they get religious in prison, is also a part of it. The teaching part of it, an example of that are correspondence courses that people like Lutheran Bible Institute and others are doing so that people who are in prison then can learn more about the Bible, Scripture, living a spiritual life. Discipling is where there are one-on-one relationships and a person walks with an individual. And a good example in California is what's known as M2, and there are about 2,500 matchups, I believe, in California. And it's not a Christian organization, but as they indicate, about 97% of the people are Christians in that organization. And the reason they're not Christian, they get state support for it. And that means they spend once a week or once every 2 weeks, the guy goes in and visits. And I'll use the male term a great deal when I talk about prison fellowship. Not that there isn't equality, but about 95%+ of the people who are in prison are male, and a little under 5% are female. The greatest growth, however, is in the percentage growth in females going to prison. They're trying to gain equality there too, maybe. Anyway, it's going up at a more rapid rate than male, but there's so many males, they'll never catch up. And so that's an example of discipleship. And the caring and helping are programs like Salvation Army is an example that does of helping people when they come out with jobs, housing, and sometimes be able to get materials at a lower cost than otherwise they would be able to do. There's another organization that is fascinating to watch. Many of you know of Curcio, and some of you may have gone through a Lutheran Curcio yourself. I know anybody here gone through a Lutheran Curcio?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and it's called Kairos. It's trying to adapt that same program to prison. And that's a nationwide program where they operate for about 3 days. And the main emphasis is to realize the grace of God, the grace of Jesus Christ. And then they meet monthly after that at Naltrea, in which they build that relationship between the people from the outside and the people in prison. And there's a great joy relationship that they develop between them. Now, Prison Fellowship Ministry is a fellowship of men and women who, because of their love for Jesus Christ, have committed themselves to exhort and assist the church in its ministry to prisoners, ex-prisoners, and their families, and also to promote biblical standards of justice. And I think that's very important, that Prison Fellowship Ministry assists the church. And it's our belief that all parachurch organizations someday die, but the church is going to be here until the second coming of Jesus Christ. And so, based on the responsibility of people in the church. So, and we've solidified that to the extent now to be a volunteer in Prison Fellowship Ministry, you have to have a letter of approval from your pastor so that involvement with the church is there, and try and encourage churches to take responsibility for the various aspects of the ministry. If one was going to look at Prison Fellowship Ministry like construction labor, the hiring hall is the church. I mean, that's where the volunteers are, just like you go to the hiring hall to get employees, and the place where you work are two places. One is in the prison and the other one's in the community. The prison is more easily developed because there is a great high that people receive when they go into prison and work with Christians in prison. Because when I first did that in Lorton Penitentiary, it was like meeting first century Christians, because these men only knew what they had read in the New Testament. They hadn't had any experience with the Christian community outside, and they were learning from the scriptures and putting it into practice. And so it had a vitality about it. So you're just really on high when you leave there. And then I recognize also that when you leave, you know that they'll slam the doors and the inmate stays there and you go back home. But the biggest difficulty in the area of corrections is nobody walks with an ex-prisoner when they come out, and nobody's doing much with the family when the person is in prison. And in our system, at least the state takes care of the prisoner. It costs between $17,000 and $20,000 to keep a prisoner. That doesn't count the cost of construction, which is now getting enormously expensive. And then, so often, the family goes on welfare, and so that's a cost to the taxpayer as well. And they suffer the onus in the community. At least the prisoner can get out of the community for a period of time, and he suffers it after he gets out. But for volunteers, when the person comes out, it's different. Then that inmate may show up at your doorstep. And that's the fearful part of it. And I always think of that story of the victim, not the prisoner, but in the Bible, of the Good Samaritan, the priest and the Levite going the other side of the road. You know, if they'd have helped that person, they'd have been stuck with him. But the foreigner could come and take care of him, and he could go home and send money. And it's a lot easier to go home and send money than it is to have them come to your home. And that's really why the priest of Levite walked around him. In our ministry, we have a number of programs. I can give you an idea of the size of it. There are area directors working in all of the 48 states in the continental United States. And there are about 35,000 to 40,000 people who are volunteering in one way or another. But there's probably about 9,000 who are volunteering continuously. That's the size of the operation that we're dealing with. And the first program that one would look at is in-prison seminars. It's a three-day seminar, and best could be explained as a mini Billy Graham evangelism time in prison, because there's about one volunteer per five inmates, and it's a series over those 3 days of the trained instructors. We train the instructors over there. About a 3 days worth of training to get them ready for this sort of thing, and then they continue on. And they take 20 minutes to half an hour in their teaching, and then the volunteers lead the inmates in the discussion afterwards over what had just been taught, and they keep that up for 3 days. And there's fascinating things that come out of it. I was in a Massachusetts prison, and talking with a guy there, you know, that tough face that he had, but when a person comes to know Christ, their face begins to mellow. And I saw his face was beginning to mellow, and was talking with him what had happened. And he'd evidently been abused when he was a child, which is a very high percentage of all the people who are in prison were abused as a child, something at least over 80%. And he was so angry that he wanted to hurt people. And he looked like he was about 40 years of age, and he'd been spending his life hurting people. And not only did he want to hurt guards, but fellow prisoners as well. Anybody he could beat up, you know, he's just getting his, venting his emotions that way. And he was told by the guy who's supplying his drugs in prison, and drugs are pretty rampant in prison. I've known some of the people who sold the drugs in prison, so they're able to get them in numerous ways. But the guy who's going to provide the drugs for him told him to meet him at that in-prison seminar that was going to be a meeting. And so he went to the in-prison seminar in order to get his drugs. But then when he got out of a cell complex, he went to the in-prison seminar, and he couldn't get back again, so he had to sit through the session, sort of like in a room like that. And so he had to sit there and listen to him. And he came to know Christ just sitting in that session in that way. And so here was a guy eagerly finding out about it. And he said no way before in his life had he ever understood the concept of love. And now, knowing Christ, the concept of love was coming to him as he was growing and learning. I could see why his face was mellowing from that. And so, you know, you get marvelous experiences from that that you hear about. But I hasten to say in this business that there's an awful lot of failures as well. I'm guessing because of my cold, I'm running out. I may run out of gas here without any water next time I ought to do that or something like that, if there's anything. So I hate to ask you after going to Esther's program on Eve this morning, but Thank you. But she's heard this, me talk about it before. So that's the in-prison seminar. We follow that up with Bible study leaders, or other Christian groups have Bible studies, because Bible studies tend to be the thing the number of churches or just ma and pa operations enjoy doing. And so from that time, try to sign them up and get them going to Bible studies. We develop some Bible study material in prison fellowship, but we use a great deal of others like the Navigators as well afterwards. And then another program that is utilized by prison fellowship now is what was called Angel Tree. And last year, about 108,000 inmates' kids had presents purchased for them. What you do this is you give them an opportunity to sign up and say who their children are, where they're living with the other parent or guardian, and then we distribute that amongst churches, hopefully in the community where the family lives. The people in the church pick an angel off, that's what we call angel tree, off the tree, and then they buy the presents. We contact the family and see what the child needs. We go to 18 years of age. And there's when you compare this with a similar program that Salvation Army does, Salvation Army is primarily in toys, and we have a tremendous request for clothing by the people who, the kids, we go to older age as well. And then hopefully in the process, a contact can be made with a family in the church and the family in the community, the inmates, the family out of that operation. We do it so that the gift is given in the name of the Father, and rather than the credit for the gift coming to the person in the church who is giving the gift, but from the Father, we try and get some connection with the family in that way. And the second really thrilling thing, that was in the same prison in Massachusetts, and probably it was, I wanted to go into a part of the prison where the people were now serving life sentence. Prior to the Willie Horton episode, people, even who were lifers, if they had the right activities, had been given an opportunity for a furlough. Thank you, Gretchen.
You're welcome.
And after the election, the state of Massachusetts eliminated furloughs. And the people in that part of the prison, you know, many of them wanted capital punishment. There was no hope for them anymore, and so why stay in prison? It'd be better to be killed, as they said. And so I wanted to go in and visit with those folks. And this guy, Frank, that I talked to you about before was there. Another person by the name of Peter Kane. Peter Kane, you know, with all his suspicions about these people, did give the names for his kids. He had been married, or at least his children, three children were from three different women, and none of the children were with any of the three women. They were with Peter's mother. And when the person then brought the presents for the children and saw that the home was so poor, they went back again and bought the food and everything so they could have Christmas, and they gave up their Christmas, had their Christmas celebration, bought all the food for it. And Peter's mother said that they couldn't have had presents, they hardly had enough money just to buy some simple food, and then they had this. And Peter said he really realized that Jesus Christ was for real from that expression of a family. And so now, because of that, he was becoming involved in the Christian community within in the prison. And what we've been trying to teach the people who are volunteers is that the church is really four things. The church is the body of Christ. The church is the denomination. The church is the congregation that we know, but the church is also that entity in the prison that the chaplain heads up. And so that can become viewed in the sense of church. And so that's the Angel Tree program. As I was mentioning the aftercare in the beginning, when I became involved with Prison Fellowship Ministry, I started out as an area director for Minnesota and North Dakota. And I was intrigued with the fact that some people stayed out of prison and others went back in again. And so I made a point to interview a number of people who had successfully stayed out of prison for a period of time, and especially people who were active in their church. And I found, as the red thread, the factor in every one of the cases, male or female, they could always point to the person who walked with them when they came out. And when I talked to the people who were back in again for the second, third, or fourth time, and then someone would say, I put myself back in. Someone would tell me, by noon of the day they were out, they were so frustrated that they went into a bar or a friend gave them the drugs, and they weren't back in prison, but for a period of time they were back in prison again. There was nobody who would walk with them other than their old friends that had gotten them into difficulty before. And so that, therefore, we have developed a mentoring program. And I went to Amicus in Minnesota, which has been doing this with people for some time, and learned some from them, and now we developed a mentoring program to encourage people in churches then to start visiting an individual while they're in prison, and then walk with them when they come out, and help them as a friend would do when they come out. And that's our new mentoring program that's being developed. A part of that is what we call Philemon Fellowship. So after a person's been out for a period of time, and they have they're responsible citizens and members of their church, that then they can come together and share together from that experience, which is tough for them to do, because most people in prison want to forget about that prison experience when they come out, because of the onus on them. They'll be asked, you know, where were you? And they say, well, I was in school. And because they're away at prison, they don't want to tell people because it was that kind of an onus on them. But in the Philemon Fellowship, they join together and then invite people who are fresh out of prison to come and meet with them, and so they too can help them and share with their troubles and problems that they have. And I should mention just a couple other programs too. We have a community service project, which we've used in a few places, and that is where inmates towards the end of their sentence come out, and each one lives in the home of church members. So if there's a half a dozen, and then for 2 weeks, and then they work on the home, say, of a poor person whose house needs rehabbing, and so they rehab that, sort of like Habitat for Humanity does. And then with the church, they provide spiritual training during that period of time, and hope that they will go back into prison and give some leadership back there. It helps them make that transition back to the community again. It changes the stereotype so that church people don't look at the prisoners as evil individuals that nothing can be done about. And so that is an attempt to enhance that reconciliation back into the community. Again, very difficult with state prisons. It's been easier with federal prisons, because a lot of people in the state are so fearful of something happening, they just want to keep them locked up till the last day of their sentence, and then it's no longer their responsibility, and then they can go back into the community. And it's hard to do that, but we're breaking through in some of the states. Another one is marriage seminars. Most of the marriages break up when a person goes to prison, and the ones that don't, a large percentage of them break up when they come out. Because if a guy's been in prison for 5 years, and he's got all these ideas of how he's really the strength of the family and he can dictate, and he gets home and his wife has been running the family for 5 years and she isn't going to give up that. And so it's just an enormous readjustment. And so people who have served time, the husband and wife who have made the adjustment, go to the prison. The wife comes and visits, and the prison permits them for, say, a weekend period of 3 days to spend that time and learn before they go out some things on how they can adjust. And now we have developed enough so that we have similar husband and wife, former inmates, who can come in as volunteers so they can handle a larger group there with the trained instructor. And the last one is the pen pal program. And right now there are about 3,000 pen pals that are operating in about 3,500 of people who write letters to prisoners, because about half of the people in prison, nobody visits them, nobody writes to them. You know, they've been in there before, everybody was close to them, lost faith in them, and so they're plumb out of it. And so to have a pen pal person to write to them is very helpful. We match people from one state with another because a lot of people in the pen pal business are very good in writing letters, but they can get conned pretty easily. And so in order to protect them, we do that on our national pen pal program. One of the unique things about Prison Fellowship Ministry is a national ministry. And that has been enabling us to develop a relationship with the systems, the Federal Bureau of Prisons and the state systems, as we prove ourselves. And the standard exists across the country so that if we prove ourselves in one state, the word gets out and are accepted in the prisons in another state. And the second reason why it's important, I think, that we're a national organization. And I'll use an example. An attorney for the Teamsters in Fargo-Moorhead, Minnesota, went to prison. And when he came out, an individual in Fargo became his mentor and helped him. The automobile company that Fred worked for, he also had an agency in Scottsdale, and he sent him down to Scottsdale. And his mentor was really worried that this fresh new Christian who had gotten started with prison fellowship work in prison would go down to Scottsdale and get in trouble down there. So he gave me a call, and I called our area director in Phoenix, and Fred hadn't been down there 24 hours, and he had lunch with our director in Phoenix, and he hooked him up with a mentor down there. And then when he moved to Texas, we did the same thing. And when he went back up to Fargo, we went back with his old mentor again. So we're trying to develop that kind of a network so that when a person moves one area to the other until he can stand on his own, we're able to help him. Let me point out, before I open it up, and I'll do it then and let you ask questions about this whole operation. You know, there's an awful lot of people who are wary of people who have committed crimes. And I met a person in Florida. His family became members of a church while he's in prison, and they befriended his family so much that he decided he would join. And 20 people out of that church left the congregation because he admitted this ex-con come into the prison. And so the other part of it is, some people look at a person who comes to know Christ, and that from then on they're perfect. You know, they can't understand it. I recall even sitting in a group where we're in Minnesota of people working in prison ministry, and one of the chaplains said, you know, I can't understand it. This person starts coming to the chapel and becomes involved, he gets out, and he commits a crime again, and he's right back in. And we were studying in the Gospel of John with that group, and it finally came to a conclusion to me, and I asked the people around the room, I said, was there ever a sin that you committed to God and pledged you would never do it again and vowed to yourself you would never do it again? I said, did you ever commit that sin again? And everybody was silent for a long time. Finally, one person nodded their head, and the others. And then the chaplain said, it finally dawned on me, they're no different than the rest of us. We sin, and then we're forgiven, we come back again. The difference with us, we don't get arrested for what we commit. They get arrested, and they're back in prison again. So you have to have that same kind of patience with them. You need only to think about, as we study the scriptures, some famous people in the scriptures. You know, the greatest lawgiver of all time, the center in the House of Representatives in Washington, of all the lawgivers' bus, is Moses, right up there. And he was a murderer. He murdered that Egyptian before he escaped, went out into the desert for 40 years. Then you think of for the Israelites, the greatest king they ever had was David. They always hark back to David. He committed adultery and had the husband of the woman killed. And then you think of the greatest missionary of all time who wrote so much of the New Testament. And he was in charge of killing Christians. And so you can look at how God can look into the hearts of people and how he can see that there's hope for individuals who are serving time in prison if they come to know him and walk in his way. And that's really what this ministry is about that we're attempting to do. Well, I'm not going to keep talking anymore. Now I want to open it up to questions, and then you'll get some more out of me if you have any questions you want to ask about this.
Does the ELCA Church have any program similar to this?
Not on a nationwide prison program. I talked to the president, no, the bishop, that's right, called bishop. He hoped that after they get this whole reorganization done, which probably take 10 years, that they might start addressing themselves to it. And the way they're going, maybe it'll take a little longer than that. But no, there isn't anything like that. The ELCA, however, has one congregation in prison in Maryland. I believe it's in Jessup Prison in Maryland, where they have a congregation in prison. So that extent. And they are doing some things on it. Mainline Christians have the staying power, however, as Pentecostal charismatic Christians do. Might also mention that, but that's one of the facts of life. Yes.
In the various prison ministries, do they at any time undertake to enable the prisoners to know their God-given skills and talents?
That
can be used in the world. I'm not talking about the list of 25 or 6, whatever Paul said there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about skills for a job. Is that what you're talking about?
If you like.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to know if I understand right for you.
Skills for life.
The skills for life. Yeah, okay. Our own program in the in-prison seminars, we work on that. And before a person comes out, we call it a life action plan. So we can go through that so they can learn the skills that they need and how they can adjust outside. However, we do not have, I think, operating by and large, the ability to provide the kind of training for the skills, the extent that I think you may be talking about. Because we tend to be heavy on the spiritual side and less on the physical side, mostly because the physical side is so expensive and it takes a longer period of time. We are just developing, however, an urban ministry, because 47% of all the people in prison are black. And if you're going to follow people when they come out, that means you're going to get into the center city. And we don't know. You know, no white ministry really knows how to do that. And so we started about 2 years ago in Los Angeles, so we figured I might as well go to the toughest area there was. And 8 black pastors have committed their church in working in that area to develop a way in which we can do that very sort of thing. And we're just going to be signing the lease now for an urban center in Los Angeles, in which the one church of the 8 purchased the building, and they have all the downstairs part of it, and then the whole upstairs is 7,000 square feet. We're going to be involved with helping when they come out and further develop their skills and their ability to secure a job, and looking for a place so they can have housing for a period of time after they come out and make that kind of adjustment. So connected with our programs of teaching them life skills and then a life action plan, we can be doing the follow-through to a larger scale than dependent on individual churches or families doing it. Because what I found is that black churches and black pastors were even more fearful of inmates coming out than white churches and white pastors, which was a total surprise to me until I started working with the people in Los Angeles. And I suppose it is because white pastors usually live some places nobody's shooting through their windows, and they're dealing right outside their church. And that's where they have a more difficult time. So that's an effort. But I'd have to tell you that whether it's the churches or other organization, we've really fallen down in that regard in most states.
I'd like to talk to you about that kind of thing a little later.
Okay.
Okay. Yes.
Typically, for example, talking about Minnesota, Stillwater or Sandstone, the chaplain's office, does it work very closely with the organization? Would that be a typical arrangement throughout the country that the chaplain's office and your organization work hand in hand, or what is that relationship?
Yes, if we are involved at all, we're working very closely with the chaplain or else the religious advisor, because some of these states are moving away from chaplains. They can't afford to hire them. Some of that other business is going on. But yes, if we can't get along with the chaplain, we're not in. We don't try to circumvent the chaplain and go with some of the activities advisors within the prison. Bill Glass does. He's gone around that. But we want to work with him, so we just stay with that whole concept of the church within prison.
Are you at Sandstone?
Yeah, we're at Sandstone. We're at all the prisons except St. Cloud, and had difficulty with a Lutheran chaplain up there, and are just working on overcoming that now. And it was a good example of winning a battle and losing the war up there. It takes a long time to overcome that. Prison Fellowship had some difficulty in this beginning, and it started with Memphis, Tennessee, in a new federal prison. And because Norm Carlson, the head of the Bureau of Federal Prisons, wanted to save some money, and he had helped us get into the federal prisons right away, he asked Chuck Olson if they would provide the religious services. And Chuck was still laboring under the delusion that the pastor was paid by the system, so therefore they couldn't trust him. But these volunteers who didn't pay then could come in there and they'd be more likely to reach and help you in your spiritual life and everything else. And what happened is if that was successful, every chaplain in the federal and state prisons would lose their jobs. And they all turned against us. And so then you had to overcome that terrible mistake that we made at that time. I mean, it's just like going into the church and saying, you're paying that guy to preach those sermons, we'll come in there and do it for nothing. And therefore, it's really out of the heart because we aren't being paid for it. You know? And you know how far we get in the church, and that's how far we got in the prisons with it. And that was a part of the chaplain up there. He was really ticked at that. So we're coming out of it now. Yes?
Can you give some examples of what specifically people would do in the mentoring program? I'm sure it's quite variable, but just talk a little bit about that.
What it is, to be similar to the person in an AA program who you can call at any time of the day or night. Mm-hmm. That sort of. Now some have gone so far as to invite the former inmate into their home and to live with them. So that's going way beyond, which some of them is probably even safe to do. But some people do to that extent. But I would say the closest thing is to be a friend. And in our arrangement, and then you make a commitment to each other. It's different with a friend, you sort of develop that. But in a true friendship, you learn to rebuke the other person as well. And so we try and teach them that so that they can rebuke each other as well as encourage each other. And so as a friend, what you do is to help the person find the avenues where he can look for a job, or to be there when he comes out of prison and help him go and find his housing that night. And to make it a, your own church available, if that's what he's interested, or if he's interested in another church, because it may be that, for instance, that you aren't involved in a charismatic church, and he's really a charismatic, and he'd sooner be over in that church. And then what we tell him to do is to go with him to the other church. Don't go to your church, go there, and then develop a friend over that church who will welcome him when he comes into the church. So that kind of a connection. But keep turning him loose and helping him to be independent, rather than becoming an enabler and doing it for him so he becomes dependent on you. Mm-hmm. You know, our end goal is that the person would be in the body of Christ, and the visible evidence of that is active in their own church, and be a responsible citizen in their community. That's what it's all moving towards.
Do you have some kind of sort of standard level of commitment, like you'll talk to the person once a week or once
yeah.
a month?
Yeah, we have a, so they sign a commitment with each other that they'll be available, so they can, they don't say, hey, you told me, you say, we have it right, black and white, so they can do that. And so, and we have it a minimum of 6 months, encourage a year in which they would do it. So, but we have, you know, take a guy like Bob Clemens, an insurance man up in Sandstone, was a Bible study leader up there, and he developed a relationship with one of them, because in the federal prison they tend to go elsewhere, but he's coming back to the Twin Cities, continued to walk with them in that way. They didn't belong to the same church, but he was just available in every way, and Mike would come over and visit with him at night in his troubles, and then go back again with new encouragement to go the next day. So, as a, I'd say it was to be like Christ. I mean, first Christ was a friend. He didn't go out there and slay him with a book. He was a friend, and then he shared an understanding of the Father with him. And that's the way it would operate.
You mentioned at the outset that the prisons have grown three times and may double again.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about what you see going on just generally in society that makes that the reality? Is it that our justice system is operating differently? Is it that there's more crime going on in the community and more apprehension is taking place? And what do you see then as the role of the church at that level in terms of where should the church be in terms of trying to stop that trend, let's say, of crime wherever that takes place, and not once the person gets to prison, but what can be the role of the church in creating a more healthy environment in which to live, crime less?
Well, one of the things that happened in society is that we gave up on rehabilitation in prison. And pretty much it was accepted it didn't work. Maybe it didn't work, we didn't put enough into it. But anyway, so there's a great change in attitude now towards, like, throw them in there and throw the key away and get them as far away as possible. And so there's a tendency to build many times prisons far away so the families can't even get to them. They don't even think about the family, just to get them in there and hold them there, as though that punishment now is going to deter crime. And so there's a great feeling. Also, politically, you know, when Nixon ran for president in 1960, he tried to do it on an anti-crime plank, and it didn't work at all, because there it seemed to people in the center city, to blacks, it was sort of like it was anti-black and anti-city, sort of unspoken way of really getting at them. So they really turned against that. You know, that whole feeling of anti-crime has developed there as well now. And so it has caused politicians to run on that platform. Even Dianne Feinstein now is running on capital punishment, one of her planks on her ticket. You know, that's why it's all moved in 25 years from about 47% of the people in favor of capital punishment to something now well over 80% in favor of capital punishment. And so I think that's one of the parts that's done it. But I think there's, and then it's interesting, when the prison population goes up, the crime goes up. For a good reason, you know, they're getting trained better. No.
Isn't there
on crime. And the last one I'd say is, I think we're bearing fruit now on what has been the breakdown of the family, the unwillingness to have moral absolutes. And so that's rampant all the way through from our business community, our political community. I mean, I run across judges, congressmen, governors, doctors, attorneys, people who are corporate heads, and then middle management, you know, they go to these prisons. So it isn't just in the ghetto that we're talking about that the morality has changed. It has all through our society. And I think that's the basic core of it. When Bill Moyers did that great series on the plight of the black family, in one of the last few frames, it was a woman standing. The whole bottom core of the issue is morality, and she said morality comes from God. And we've forgotten God. I think that's it. Yes?
Isn't there some research going on right now on alternative forms of punishment?
Yeah, there is quite a bit. And it's pretty successful. But we're still back in a different mindset than permitting that. You know, you wouldn't need prison because they have that electronic device that a person could wear and stay in their own home, keep working. All those things that are more modern way of handling it. In fact, I think stocks in the Village Square is more humane than what we do now.
Yeah.
Throwing people in prison. Yes, Dan?
I'm just struck, this past year I've been living in New York City, and I'm much more contact with the African American community than I did when I was in Minnesota, but I just sense a tremendous amount of anger and despair among African Americans now. Particularly when there was a study that came out that made the claim that one out of every four African American men between the age, I think it was 20 and 45, is in prison or on parole or on probation, and that there are more African American men in prison than there are in higher education. And then the African Americans I've talked to just feel so angry about this, and then especially with the trend of the majority of the country just building more prisons, locking more people away, they really feel like the white majority in this country is simply writing off the African American community, and their answer to African American problems is to build more prisons and get them out of sight.
Mm-hmm.
And I am really fearful, particularly in the urban communities, that I think we're building into another explosion because of the kind of despair that's happening. I think our lack of political leadership in those areas. I know there's a lot of problems, but I don't want to say there's any easy solution, but at least the perception has been that we're just writing off the African American community in the inner cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call it black male genocide because it was happening there. And it's interesting as far as the killing goes on so much within themselves, you know, there isn't white people shooting or anything like that, you know, with all the drug wars and whatever thing else they're having there. And you know, it isn't easy because as people achieve and then they move out, the biggest exodus out of the cities now are not white people, but black people. And so they aren't there providing the leadership to the people who are left behind. And if one thinks that they understand the inner city black community, if you know blacks in the suburbs, you don't. They think differently from each other. And that's why we went into the inner city and told them, you had all kinds of white people coming in before and telling you how you ought to run it, and then when things got tough, they left. And we made a commitment we're going to stay, and that we don't know what to do. And we said, evidently you don't know either, otherwise you would have done it. And let's now work together and see if we can learn together with that. And that's why they may. And an interesting thing is that if we can develop a model in Los Angeles, they do have a network in the center cities, you know, with Detroit, which there is much better political black leadership over in Detroit, but with Chicago and so forth. Now that we hope we can learn how to work in Miami too, that we're going to be working there too with a different ethnic group. in Miami. But I think we just have to say we don't know, but we commit ourselves to start doing something about it.
Is Jesse Jackson involved at all in your programs? Or?
No, he's not. He's not.
Isn't Should he be?
What?
Should he be?
Well, I don't know if he's got an awful lot to do in his own programs, too. I think it's more important that we not be at odds with each other, that we learn how to cooperate with each other, rather than he be in our program and so forth. The first match that we have done is with trying to do some cooperation with Bill Glass. But when I went to work with Prison Fellowship Ministry, a friend of mine in Washington, D.C. said that if I could get Christians working together, they'd give me a bigger award than they'd give Mother Teresa. And that's in spades in prison work, too. I mean, there's so many people that believe that, you know, their theological quirk is the most important thing there is, you know, Christ plus. And, oh, boy, we have difficulty. And so, and I think for a number of years that we were guilty as well. We may have talked one way, but I don't think our action was going correctly with it. And now that we've made the change, I think we're much, some of the chaplains in prison want us to be the leaders of bringing them together in an ecumenical way. But I think we have to work that way. For instance, with another one we did when I was there with M2 in California, said we'll stop our one-on-one program and just work with you. Anybody do one-on-one, we'll do with M2 out there. So I think we can build. So it's not only with Christian groups, the ones who might, because they get state or public funding, we can work together as well. Listen. But no, we're pretty new, and we're only a year in Chicago. And our guy, Bill Watt, knows Jesse Jackson, the programs there as well. But he's getting that up and running. So he'll cooperate with us, but hey, Jesse Jackson is doing with us. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how this works? Like, if people are interested, they know about you, do you have contact congregations?
Yes.
Does each state run itself a little bit different because you're in different directions?
Well, there's a great deal of similarity, but I also notice, however, that there's a tendency of the churches, of the denomination, the area director, to be more involved than other churches. So Indiana, for example, Ken Jackson is our area director. He's a Methodist, and there seems to be a heavier Methodist involvement there than any other state but Louisiana, and there is a former bishop who went to prison and is now one of our area directors. He connected up that way. And in Minnesota, Luther started looking a little more favorably at prison fellowship. I was the area director out there than before. But what happens is area directors, and then they get some volunteers to help them make church presentations, lay out what is available there, and see if God has laid it on the hearts of any of the people within the church to work and volunteer in the ministry. That's really just making church presentations that way. And some of them now have gone to the point where a church takes responsibility and puts on the marriage seminar. Say, we'll be the marriage seminar church and teach that. Mm-hmm. Is one of the people who are there. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, you getting hungry?
No.
You are. I'll let you go and head out there if nobody's got any other question. You were about to say something. Wait, no, you weren't. You just put your foot up, yeah. You look like you're about to propound something.
No.
Tell us about Wisconsin.
I was wondering, seminary students now, are they required to do some prison ministry, or is that an optional?
No, that's an optional part of it. So, a Luther seminary student was working in Stillwater Prison for a while as an example. And he stayed in the prison ministry. So he'd probably be a chaplain. So.
They do that out of Lutheran Northwestern in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. It's, as you say, optional, because I know our son did that. Mm-hmm. I think it was, they're required to do so many of these electives, I guess.
Yes, huh?
And he did it for a quarter, and he liked it so well, he stayed the whole year.
Oh.
Because he thought the people in prison were so hungry for the word.
Mm-hmm.
He just felt that mm-hmm. intensity.
Did he do it in Stillwater?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other interesting thing, you don't find them all in chapel either. I've worked with some in Stillwater Prison, and they just won't have anything to do with the chapel because, as they put it, that's where the baby rapers are. And so those who have committed those kind of crimes, they feel are there, and they look at them as weak individuals and hiding out there, and they don't want to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. There was a guy once, however, by the name of Hank Steves, who changed all that for a period of time, but when he left Stillwater, it went back to some of their old attitudes again. And Hank Steves was a guy who was with organized crime and involved with the whole big drug trade. And he came to know Christ there. And a woman, Lutheran pastor, led him to Christ there at Stillwater Prison. And he came off his heroin addiction with a miraculous way, with no physical effects of, when he went off cold turkey at that time. And he's now had, oh boy, 12 years straight, and he runs Hidden Ranch, the halfway house for women in Minneapolis right now. So they're talking about, you have all of these things happening in prison that you learn to understand, and people relate with each other, and people who are Christians won't go there. That's no different. A lot of Norwegians wouldn't go there if some other Norwegian went. Years passed. Well, thank you.